Hey, welcome to the Grants in Science podcast with me, your host, Morgan Giddings. And today we're going to talk about a couple things that have come up in the last week, one of which is the reason that I'm wearing my helmet. Actually, there are two reasons I'm wearing this great old kayak helmet. This one was made by a friend of mine, and it's pretty cool. It's, you know, made in the image of Martian the Marvin. Marvin the Martian. I can't speak. In any case, so... The reason I started out wearing the helmet is, number one, to protect myself, just in case anybody gets really pissed off. But more than that is to make a point about protecting yourselves and your labs and your well-being. So recently I was involved in an effort to get President Obama's attention on the issue of biomedical science funding. There, you know, in the current budget that Obama has proposed, he proposed a completely flat budget for the NIH. And what this means, this flat budget thing, is that essentially the value of the dollar has been decreasing for the last, well, it's been decreasing since forever, especially since we went off the gold standard, but that's a whole other thing. But basically, inflation over the last 10 years or so has wiped out about one-third of the value of the dollar. Depends on who you believe, you know, who you look or trust for your facts, but it's around one-third, according to most people who know more on the subject than I do. So what that means is the NIH budget has been flat for that same period of 10 years, flat in terms of the research dollars given out to individual scientists who are doing their own sort of cool science in their labs, trying to push the fields forward in areas like cancer research and whatever. So this flat funding collides with this inflationary thing, meaning that the basically that dollar that we've got today, that we're getting today for doing that research, is equal to one-third less than what we had 10 years ago. And so the biomedical research endeavor as a whole, which is mostly supported by NIH, not completely, is essentially shrinking by that same amount. And so the goal of this petition was to get Obama's attention on this subject of this issue, very important issue, so that he might actually propose some slight increase, just at least to keep up with inflation this year, if nothing else, because things are pretty dire. So I've been promoting this petition and trying to help out, and the first petition got within 400 signatures, and then the White House site shut it down, which is really a tragedy that we got that close and they shut it down. So my colleagues, in particular Stephen Meltzer at Johns Hopkins, got another petition going, started a new one, and we started promoting and trying to get new signatures on this. I think people were a little confused about whether this was a new petition or old petition, and they thought they'd already signed it. So it looks like the second petition, which closes in just a day or two from when I'm making this video, it looks like it's probably not going to happen unless we have a big break. And I think it's because of this issue. So so it's really unfortunate. So one of the things that we must do, is take a more active stance as a scientific community in getting the word out there about the value of the science we do. And that goes back to the reason that I was wearing the helmet. So in response to this whole petition issue, there have been a lot of emails flying around amongst various people about promoting this and just also some of the horror stories. One person sent in a particular horror story talking about how things were very difficult for her, and as they are for many, many people, and I talk to a lot of people, but in particular mentioned one specific university where now there are a whole bunch of empty labs. And when she was visiting there, she asked, well, what are these empty labs for? And they, you know, what new project are you starting and you're going to put in this lab? And the response to her was, oh, these aren't for new projects. This is empty space because the faculty couldn't get their grants renewed and are laying off staff and letting people go. Really a tragedy, really a shame that there's all this empty space because things are downsizing and whatever. I mean, there are natural cycles to these things, but it's still a shame because really science is so important for everything, for our health, for our economy, for our well-being as a species. In any case, the point that I was going to make about this is, even though that's a tragedy, there's probably a deeper tragedy here, because the particular university that this person mentioned, I had had an interaction about a year ago where I had offered a very high-end intensive grant writing course where I basically take somebody and coach them through the process of putting together a successful proposal. And so this person I talked to was from that university and signed up for this intensive grant coaching course. Then about a week later, less than a week later, I get an email back from the person who says to me, you know, look, my department chair says, no, we're not going to pay for this. We don't have the money to pay for this intensive grant work with me. Instead, my chair is going to take the time to sit down and train me how to do this and train me how to be successful in this grant writing gig. And at the time, I was kind of floored, wondering, you know, what they were thinking. And now I get this email today talking about that same university having all this empty lab space. And it drives me absolutely bonkers. I mean, just fucking bonkers. Sorry for the swear word, but this is just, you know, it's kind of ridiculous that, yes, budgets are shrinking and we need to do something about it. And I will continue to fight to get attention on the issue that we need more science funding. We need it to at least stay steady with inflation, if not increase, because science is really important and I believe in it. But at the same time, there's this attitude like, well, it's all this stuff, bad stuff out there that those people are doing to us, and us poor scientists, we can't do anything about it, and we don't have the money to do anything about it, and, you know, we're smart and we can just figure it out. Look, I've tried to go down that road before. I've started 6 different businesses. 5 of those businesses failed, and you know the number one reason that 5 of those businesses failed, 5, count them, and wasted a ton of my money and a ton of other people's money in the process, is because I went into these businesses with the attitude of, oh, I'm really smart, because, you know, people always told me I was smart, and I did lots of smart stuff, like getting PhDs and postdocs and blah, 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 all sorts of credentials, okay? So I was smart. I went into these businesses with the attitude, I'm too smart, I don't need any help, I can figure this out, I know how to do it. 5 businesses failed. You know what the difference is? I've run 1 successful business so far, truly successful. It has grown ever since day one. And the one difference is I went into that business with the attitude of, you know, I may be smart, but I don't know everything. And so you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to learn everything I can about how to run a successful business. Made all the difference in the world. I have spent a ton on mentors and advisors and training programs, some of which were more valuable than others, but every single time I have engaged to learn something, I have learned at least one thing, if not more than one thing, and it has paid for itself. And yet, here we are looking at an academic department that's got all this empty space and is struggling, and when they had an opportunity to take one of their faculty and help that person with his skills so that he could be much, much better at this grant writing game. Maybe not perfect. Nobody's going to be perfect, but at least better, so his odds are better. And those, it doesn't take many, you know, much increased odds in terms of getting grants to start paying off pretty big time. So, you know, they're thinking about it and saying, no, we don't need to invest in that. We'll figure it out ourselves. You know, that department chairs are busy. They're busy as hell. There's no way that that department chair is going to sit down and spend the time with this guy, walking him through from beginning to end of really how to write a very successful grant proposal based on proven principles that have worked for hundreds of people. It's just not going to happen. I'm sorry. It's unrealistic. So this chair is basically slitting his own throat by saying, oh, I'm not going to invest some X number of thousands of dollars into this thing because I can do it better. Bullshit. That is bullshit. And the bigger picture, the reason for the, you know, aside from the fact that this may anger some people, but the bigger reason for the helmet is just, you know, you've got to learn in this environment. If you're a scientist, a practicing scientist, you have got to put your helmet on. So what is your helmet? Your helmet is learning how to effectively market your science better, learning how to communicate your science better, learning how to convey the value of your science. And it's not only conveying the value of your science, it's also the actual act of picking science to do intentionally that is the highest value science. You know, so many of us, I don't know about you, but for me, there are, you know, 100 different topics that I could be doing research on, and one of the reasons I've chosen the research topics that I have chosen over time is because those are topics that people care about and that are kind of leading edge and that there's interest in, and that's one of the reasons I choose them. everybody gets to make that choice. They get to make the choice of, do I keep doing the same old thing that nobody's really interested in anymore, or do I do something new and different that people are interested in and excited in, and that they would want to give me more money to keep pushing forward on? You have that choice. Everybody has that choice. So putting your helmet on is about being strategic. I'm going to put the actual helmet on. Being strategic about what it is that you are doing and how you are communicating about what you are doing. And those are the sort of two key strategic pillars that everybody needs to be doing in this environment if they want to survive, if they don't want those layoffs and those closed down labs and those bad situations. And yet, the biggest challenge for most people is they are so damn busy and so lost that probably they didn't even watch this far into the podcast or listen this far into the podcast, but they're so damn busy that they don't even want to take the time to learn how to really fundamentally improve their skills in these areas. It's like, oh, I'm too busy putting out this fire and 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 being desperate and running around with my head cut off and blah, 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 blah. And they don't take the time to strategically plan. I'll tell you, 1 hour of strategic planning is worth about 100 hours of running around just doing stuff and checking your email and being busy. 1 hour of strategic planning. And I'll bet you that most of my colleagues don't even do 1 hour of strategic planning every month. Maybe not even 1 hour of really, truly strategic planning every year. In the big picture, how am I going to, what's the best science for me to be doing? How am I going to promote that science? How am I going to communicate that science? What grants am I going to go after? Or how else am I going to get this funded? That kind of big picture, strategic sort of creative thinking. Very, very few people do that. And yet, it is absolutely essential. Very few people also seek out training. I mean, I happen to know. I email out, I have a newsletter list of quite a few people that I share tips and secrets and stuff like that related to science careers, and only a tiny fraction take me up on grant writing advice, even when I've offered grant writing courses at a major discount as a sale or a thank you, whatever, special. Very few people actually take me up on these things. And, you know, I can tell, I mean, there are some who do, and some will be like, on my email list for several years, and then finally they'll decide, okay, it's time, take me up on this, you know. But so few people actively seek out training in things like grant writing, in things like more efficient lab management, more efficient management of personnel. I mean, there are quite a few people who've come to me for the grant writing help and some of the classes I take, and people go to other sort of grantsmanship seminars and stuff like that. But very few people really make a point. Like, if let's say you spend 5 years on a PhD, on working hard to develop the skills and the independence and, you know, the sort of the mental game that you need to do your science independently. 5 years, 5 years of work. Now, how much time compared to that have you actually spent developing similar skills of communication and grant writing and giving a great talk and all of that kind of related stuff? Probably, you know, even if you've gone to a lot of seminars, it's just a tiny, tiny drop in the bucket. And yet, if you don't do those things effectively, that communication effectively, if you don't do the grant writing effectively, then all the science is a moot point. You can't do the science without the funds. So really, you should be spending just as much time training in how to effectively communicate, because it's just as hard of a skill. Really effective communication, really effective marketing of your science, really effective grant writing is a skill that is just as difficult and time-consuming to develop as is, you know, developing your ability to do independent science. It takes time, it takes effort, it takes practice. And if you're not practicing, you're falling behind. So I know I'm on a bit of a soapbox here, but it just, you know, it drives me crazy that people are not thinking about their helmets. They're taking their helmets off. They're going down the whitewater river of life, helmetless, ready to get turned over and jumbled around on the rocks. And maybe they'll stay upright. Really good kayakers on a whitewater river will often stay upright and not flip over. I've been kayaking for many years, so quite often, in fact, I've rarely ever needed my helmet. But on about two or three occasions, there I have flipped over in my kayak and bashed my helmet against a rock. And on those two or three occasions, this helmet, this friggin' helmet, saved my life. So where's your helmet in your career? Where is your helmet in your career? That's what I've got to ask you about. So I just hope you'll really think about that. Have you got a helmet? Have you got a plan? Have you developed strategically how you're going to build these skills so that you can survive in this really tight environment? It's a tight environment and it's not going to get better. So you've got to do it. And if this pisses you off, then fine. Go back to doing what you're doing. And, you know, I'm sorry, but your results are going to be about the same as they've been for the last few years, if not worse. But hopefully you'll listen to this and start getting into action, making a plan, and seeking out training on this stuff. Really important. So the second thing I want to talk to you about today is teaching and how to teach as effectively as possible. So I was speaking to somebody who has to teach a class of medical students about microbiology or molecular biology, sorry. And this person was complaining about a couple things. One, the student reviews that had come in last year were not so hot for this person and were kind of insulting in some ways. And the second thing is the person had a little bit of a challenge or an attitude that, you know, these students don't want to be here. They don't really want to learn this stuff. And so they're kind of wasting my time. And so I feel like this is just such a waste of time. And it was clearly a very frustrating endeavor for everybody involved, for both this instructor and the students. Now, that's the reality in modern classes, is that most students don't want to be there. It depends on the subject. Now, if you're talking about graduate school in a particular field of interest for a student, maybe that student actually wants to be there. There are some exceptions in cases like that, but the vast majority of students in med school and in undergraduate students just don't want to be in the classes that they're in because basically most of those classes are ones that they have to take. They are a requirement of the degree. And so the student shows up with this attitude like, why am I learning this? How is this relevant to me? I mean, I'll be honest that of all the classes I took back in my college days, very few things that I learned during those college days are actually in use for me now. There are a few things, but not that many. So a lot of the classes that I took were kind of useless to me. I mean, I found some of them interesting. I found other ones really tedious, but a lot of it wasn't useful. And one of the reasons that students have real challenges with this is because they're not given a reason to care about the learning. They're not given any sense of excitement about the learning. They're just sort of there because they have to be there and because they know they have to get a grade. And what the big failure point on a lot of instructors is to go into the class assuming that these students are already primed and ready and interested in learning this material. You know, the number one thing I teach in terms of marketing or grant writing or anything else is the first thing you have to do is capture the reader's interest. Have to capture their interest. It's like I started out this video. I wore the helmet in part to capture your interest, right? So, I guess if you're listening in, you can't see the helmet, but in any case. So you've got to capture interest. You've got to get that intrigue going. You've got to get somebody thinking, okay, there's something in this for me and I should pay attention. And it's the same thing in teaching. You know, if somebody goes into a class and they have no interest in the subject and they're just there because they have to be and because they have to get a good grade, they're going to be there with a very different attitude than if they're actually like, hey, I'd love to learn about this stuff. This stuff is exciting and I'm enthusiastic about it. So what is the number one thing you can do as a teacher to turn a situation around where you have these disengaged students sitting there, you know, wasting your time and then giving you bad critiques because you try to teach the stuff to them and they're all pissed off for whatever reason? Well, the number one way is to just simply get them interested. You know, this person I was talking to, I gave an exercise. I said, okay, imagine these two different scenarios. Imagine in scenario one that you taught these students all the facts that there currently are to know about molecular biology. You just taught them everything, like taught them this whole body of knowledge and made them memorize it, and you tested them and were sure they really knew all the facts, all the important facts of molecular biology. And so then picture them in 10 years and picture where they are and how good that was for them. You know, how much good that is doing them in their careers 10 years from now. Now, second scenario, picture instead, well, you don't really teach them too many facts. Maybe they learn a few incidental facts, but you teach them to be really intrigued and really curious about molecular biology. And you teach them how to learn more stuff about molecular biology. And so the students who go out of that class, they're a little bit deficient on the actual facts, but they've got excitement and they've got intrigue and they know how to look things up on, you know, Google or on PubMed or whatever. They know how to read a scientific paper and they know how to analyze it and gather new facts. Okay, and they're excited. Which of these two groups of students is going to be more successful in the future with relation to molecular biology? Well, if you answered group A, then I don't know what planet you're on, but in my opinion, group B is the group to go with. It's group B who, no matter how the knowledge changes or the information changes, they can keep up with the times. And they're going to keep up with the times because they're excited and motivated. So that simple exercise, if you answered B, like I hope most sane people do, then the point is you have to teach the class that way. You have to really change around how you teach. It's not about teaching a set of facts anymore when you're taking approach B. Approach A is a set of facts. It's a fixed body of knowledge, and hey, I'm going to cram this fixed body of knowledge into this person as if they were a computer. Well, they're not a computer, and that's why we have computers. We don't need more computers on the planet. We need more thinking, motivated, intelligent, compassionate, creative human beings on the planet. And Route A does not produce those. Route B produces those. So Route B is all about going into the classroom with the number one goal being, I'm going to get these students excited about this subject. Like anything else is just gravy. Like if I can help them learn some facts in the process of getting excited about this, that's a real bonus. But number one, I'm going to focus on getting them excited about this topic. And I'll tell you, there's nothing like getting people excited. Yeah, if they have to prepare for some exam or they're going to have to regurgitate some facts, then again, you might have to teach them some facts. But I would argue even in that case, the exam is kind of pointless, except that we've got to assign grades for some stupid reason. I just think the whole system in that regard is silly. But we've got to assign grades, so yeah, maybe you teach them a few facts along the way. But number one, if you're getting them excited and motivated, that will go well beyond that test period. And they won't be one of those students who just shows up for the test, regurgitates whatever they learned, and then promptly forgets it, which is what I did for a lot of my classes, and most people I know did that for their classes because so many of the classes were irrelevant. So that would be my number one piece of advice. If you want to really create the best learning environment for your students, at whatever level they're at, whether they are already interested or whether they come in totally disinterested, is focus on helping those students become interested in that subject. And not just from the perspective of you as the specialist in that subject, because you're the specialist probably because you were already interested in that subject to begin with. These kids, these people who are learning from you, are not already interested in the subject, you know, so it's your job, it's your role to bring them in and get them interested and show them what is interesting about it and make it relevant to their lives and show them why it's relevant to their lives. I mean, that's so easy to do with molecular biology. You start talking about cancer, you start talking about how neurons work. I mean, there are a zillion things that are definitely apropos to things that people are thinking about every day that you can tie the molecular biology into. But if you just come in and say, oh, here's protein and here's an enzyme and blah, 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 they come together and do such and such, then you're totally losing their interest. So, number one thing, capture interest. Keep their interest and get them excited and enthusiastic and then show them how to learn on their own so that they can go read the literature and get the facts and interpret the facts and understand them intelligently. Way more service to the world, way more service to the student, and you'll get way better teaching reviews in the process. So that is it for my rants, my diatribes for the Grants and Science podcast, except for one last thing. And the one last thing is that I almost always am giving away cool, free resources on my websites. And today I'm going to point you over to my blog. There's a special page on my blog with a little bit of information and some cool stuff that I think you're going to like. It's at morganonscience.com/media. morganonscience.com/media. There's a little article there with some statistics about current NIH funding, but at the bottom of that article, I offer you a couple cool resources. I offer you my specific AIMS template if you're ever involved in writing NIH grants. I also am going to send you my backdoor to funding report, and I'm going to send you the 5 steps to writing great grants report. It's a recent report that I put together. It's actually handwritten with a lot of pointers that I've never taught anywhere. In fact, yeah, there's one thing that I haven't even taught to my elite clients that's in this report. I'm going to go back and start teaching it to them because I realized it as I was putting it together how important this is. And I'm going to send you the Small Town Utah Girl Grant Writers Report. So you will be getting a plethora of resources by going to morganonscience.com/media and signing up there, and I'll get that stuff to you right away. So I hope you've enjoyed this, and if nothing else, please leave comments. I love your feedback. Even if you disagree, let's have a debate about it. I'm here, I'm ready to debate you and to discuss it. And if you have positive feedback, that's even better. So thanks for tuning in, and this is Morgan. Until next time, keep her rolling.